kill me while I kiss her die. Heavy duty bitches, we don't televise. We don't testify, hope each other for petty crime. Every time que me toca, dejo body sin any life. Yeah.
Like a Muslim praising the grounds of Mecca. I surround with pressure, the sound gets deeper. I get around like pounds of reefer. While you running round town trying to ice grill, we gunning them down with mic skills. We type ill, put you to bed like NyQuil. Let me be honest and quote this. Man, I'm so sick, I almost had to vomit when I wrote this. Opus filled with explosive. Grammar is so swift like a lotus. Bang hammers and four fifths, it'll hit who's closest. With no motive, I'm compulsive. Make omelets out y'all soldiers. Bomb it and scorch it like an Islamic fortress. I'm horrendous and atrocious. I step into the cipher with a vengeance to roast kids. To your man's like, ho-ish. Why'd you get him started? That fucking flow rip. Kingdom hand commandments down like Moses. I'll for them, I'm the dopest.
Nobody can touch the guy.
Alguien me enseñó a mí que el tango ha de hacerse con el 50% de lo que uno tiene. Hay que poner solamente la mitad. Y la otra mitad debe guardarse en el rincón más oscuro del alma. Me han enseñado también que el tango no es únicamente una liga con un dibujo rítmico determinado, sino antes bien una colección de géneros artísticos, entre los que está la música. Pero hay también una poesía tanguera, y hay una plástica tanguera. ¿Eh? Y hay, tal vez, modestísimamente, una manera tanguera de ver el mundo. Esto me lo han enseñado.
Los chicos criollos.
That was Los Chicos Chilsa and Criollo Gods featuring Ruen. That's a new album here on the charts at CJSF, just on our playlist as of last week. All right, let's take a quick look at the weather. It's pretty nice out there, although the forecast does call for some rain and a chance of thundershowers. I guess it's springtime. I mean, when I came up this morning, it was pretty sunny, but I guess the weather moves around a bit. The rest of the week is looking awfully nice, with sunny being what's called for. Later in the week, we got highs up to 20 and 22 degrees, reaching highs of 25 on Saturday. So not too shabby out there this week. All right. I was going to do a PSA, but let's just go straight into the next segment here, Peter.
Oh, yes. Yemen, you say it Yemen?
Yemen.
Because I heard some podcasts over the weekend, but I've been looking at mainly the Wikipedia thing about. But what it is that Saudi Arabia, I think a few weeks ago, complained at the World Economic Forum about the Israeli, what Israel's doing, you know, the Palestinians. But they, for 10 years, have been backing one side of a civil war in Yemen.
Mm-hmm.
And what it's been here since, according to the UN, I'm reading from Wikipedia.
Yeah.
According to the UN, over 150,000 people have been killed in Yemen, as well as, estimates of over 227,000 dead as a result of ongoing famine and lack of health care. Which is sort of what people were saying a bit about in the Israeli one. is like a contention too. And here's the thing: according to the Yemen Data Project, the bombing campaign has killed or injured an estimated 19,000 civilians as March 2022, and that's sort of done by the Saudi Arabians. As I mean, it's a side that they're backing, and let's see here.
The other side of it is backed by the Iranians. So yes, in some respects, it's like a proxy war between the two.
Yes.
The funniest thing about Yemen, and I don't know if it's funny or morbid, but so I have a friend who is a specialist on Yemen, and he was talking to him about this, and he was saying that originally the Houthis, it was, you know, back when they got started in the 2010s, it was a fuel protest. They're protesting an increase in the cost of fuel. And then quite by accident, almost like, you know, the plot of the producers, they just ended up taking power because the government was so inept that they were like, well, what, we're taking over now. Why don't we just run the place? And then they just kept winning, essentially. Yeah. Like, it's just the whole thing was entirely accidental because the government before them was so inept and corrupt that they just blew away, like, you know, a house of cards. Yeah. And it was incredible. And the Houthis themselves turned out to be, you know, like, without taking a side and who's right, who's wrong, whatever, they turned out to be extremely shrewd negotiators. So everyone who's ever negotiated with the Houthis come away saying that they're just incredibly skilled at focusing on what they want and getting what they want and not getting distracted by endless BS in negotiations that, like, many actors such as Saudi Arabia are inclined to do. And so that's kind of being a key part of their success, that they take over an existing regime that was falling apart, and they're very focused on their goal, and they're very kind of focused on achieving what they want and not, you know, endless BS, right? So. Yeah.
It's also how the United States has been involved, and here's in March 2019, the United States Congress voted to end U.S. support to the Saudi war effort. However, Donald Trump vetoed it. I'm reading from Wikipedia, so yep. Sorry for that, but I want to be specific what it says. Joe Biden announced a freeze on arms sales to Saudi Arabia and the UAE.
I think Joe Biden needs to make up his mind whether he likes the Saudis or not.
I think a lot of people have that problem. People like the oil. They don't necessarily like the politics the stance of the Saudis on many issues. Canada had an issue with that, too, because we were selling
LAVs.
Yeah, light armored vehicles to the Saudi Arabians, and that became a point of controversy about, you know, how they would be used in this war in Yemen.
I don't think Saudi Arabia is necessarily the worst regime in the world. They're obviously not ideal in many ways, possibly in all ways, actually. But, you know, like, the way the moral hypocrisy goes, you know, we will condemn the Saudis, but we also sell them weapons, you know, like, and we'll pretend that we're high and mighty, but, you know, when we need them, hey, come closer. To me, that is just kind of ironic, and to me, that's just kind of symptomatic of the manifold failures of our policy.
Well, one thing it says here, however, the details of the end of American involvement in the war have yet to be released. So
it's never going to be released.
Well, that's, you know, often the nature of geopolitics, though, because, you know, there are different considerations. There's, you know, concern for human rights and sort of moral issues, and then there's the real world practicality of, oh, we don't like what these guys are doing, but we need to be able to buy their resources.
But it's the same with, you know, what's the chap who runs India? Modi, right?
Yeah.
Narendra Modi. It's, you know, today we like him, tomorrow we don't. And, you know, well, we can't make up our mind. And, you know, it turns out we incurred, you know, he committed some violence on Canadian soil, and that was bad. But before that, people were all very gung-ho about embracing him. And so it's people need to make up their minds and have some kind of a consistent policy, right?
I guess, yeah. I mean, I don't disagree with you. I just think it, you know, the way the considerations people are working with, it's rarely going to happen.
Oh, yeah, no, it's, I understand, you know, they work within strictures. It's just, it's ultimately challenging, right?
Yeah, well, Stephen, you said that Saudi Arabia is not the worst regime in the world. But what I'm sort of getting at is that they were condemning Israel for what they were doing, and they're doing much the same.
I think if we're going to litigate hypocrisy in the Middle East, that's a conversation that's never going to end. So... I mean, you know, it's just that you know, like maybe I think the focus on the Middle East is just stop the bloodshed, and maybe we can all be hypocrites again civilly. And
okay, but I'm just bringing that up.
Yeah, I mean, of course.
That's a wide thought to bring up this. Now, this is something. This is not that much of a change of topic because we're still the information I got is really not about me taking either side in what's currently going on, but I was a bit surprised. How many few Holocaust survivors went to Israel in 1948?
I think that's a really interesting facet. Sorry to interrupt.
Okay, you go ahead, Stephen. You can.
Well, let Peter finish his thought first.
Well, okay. Okay. So what it was. Oh my God! It was actually in like it wasn't even 100,000.
Right.
Initially in 1948. And then what happened, it makes me wonder, where did these people go? Because the United States was not allowing people to come in. Then in June 1948, after Israel was sort of instigated, the United States allowed 200,000 European refugees into the United States. Which is not the 3.5 million Jewish survivors.
Yeah, I think the my kind of position on this whole thing has always been that, you know, the foundation of Israel has been a very challenging, a very difficult process. But I'm not like interested in litigating how it was founded, what happened in 48. You know, these things are they're quite messy. But I think much more interesting about Israel today, because this is actually in a sense quite detached from what happened in the 40s and 50s, is that Israel is not really like today. If you look at the political compass, if you like, I had a friend named David Shore, who is a strategist for the Democratic Party in the United States, and he made a three-dimensional. He is actually Jewish himself. He made a three-dimensional sort of political map of Israel. And what is really interesting is that the people who are most militaristic, who are most inclined toward a armed solution toward Palestinians, are people who immigrated from other Middle Eastern countries, Mizrahi Jews. And so, like, the question of, you know, how many whatever European, I don't think that's a relevant question in many ways. It's more that if you look at the situation within Israel today, the people most gung-ho for a more confrontational solution are from Middle Eastern. And it's one of these things where it's just a very, very challenging process. And I want to clarify, this is not meant to be anti-Israel in any way.
Yep.
David, who made this political compass, he is a Zionist, and he supports Israel's right to exist and so forth. And his parents actually grew up in Israel. And so this is like not a slam on Israel. It's just kind of a description of the electoral and political processes happening in Israel right now. And I think any part of a long-term solution of the current challenges will have to kind of put in place a situation where these kind of conflicts within Israel and without kind of are contained.
Well, anyway, I was going to make a few statements about Harry Truman. President Harry Truman is really, one could argue, one of the instigators of the State of Israel. Like, Zionism had existed since the 1890s or previous to that. But and I was always under the assumption until this weekend or a few days ago that, you know, it was sort of, okay, it's a good idea. You have 3.5 Actually, you have 3 million non-Jewish survivors of concentration camps, too. It's like 6.5 million. It's okay. It's not. What it was that I think part of what was happening was to appease the guilt of the United States. I mean, they should have just allowed them to actually emigrate to the United States, which they didn't. And I'm even shocked at here. I thought once Israel was sort of established that there was more open immigration in the United States. This is a shockingly low number. I mean, when they say here that the United States displaced at Persons Act of June 1948, 200,000 European refugees went to the United States. It also says here that they had the DP camps in Germany. These were the people that were...
Displaced persons camps.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, from the concentration camps and so on. They weren't closed finally until 1952. And Germany closed it finally in 1952. And there was one remaining camp in Fortin Ward? Yeah. You know where that is?
No.
Anyway.
No, well, you know, of course... At the end of the Second World War, there was an enormous amount of displaced persons. That's what the DP stands for. Yes. Basically refugees. You know, people who had either, you know, had homes destroyed, had communities destroyed, had fled fighting in one direction or another, and or were even, you know, moved around. There were a lot of forced laborers. But lots of, you know...
I mean, given the
scale of destruction of the war, lots of people were... There were a lot of refugees.
Okay. The last one, 1957, which is kind of a pretty long date, even though most of them had... I supposedly, by 1960, 1 million people had emigrated over to Israel. But that's still, I mean, it makes me wonder what happened. I mean, I guess there was more and more immigration to the United States of some of these survivors. But, this is really, I'm not really weighing on either side. Yeah. I'm just sort of saying that I'm kind of maybe making Harry Truman a bit guilty because I always thought, okay, maybe he was forced into instigating Israel because... that was the only way that you would allow the immigration to happen. But I don't even know what the situation was because it just seems rather odd, the whole thing, that there wasn't a lot.
Perhaps over time there was... I'd have to go fact check. I'm not 100% sure I'm right on this. But I do believe actually more people ended up in the United States. Jews from Europe ended up in the United States and ended up in Israel, at least initially.
Yeah, but
I'm not 100% certain of that. You know, I would have to go and check my facts on that.
Anyway, we got some gardening tips, don't we?
Yeah. You have a last thought on this topic here, Steve?
My last thought on this is really like I've always been an advocate of equal rights for Jews and Palestinians alike, okay. And I think that's the main thing.
Yep. So where we start with this was, of course, you know, the Saudi intervention in Yemen and what they were doing there. And it is interesting, you know, you were commenting on the sort of hypocrisy of the Saudis criticizing the Israelis while engaging in similar activity in Yemen.
Yes.
And there's a lot of truth in that, you know, and I think there's a certain hypocrisy, you know, in the West of at least for many official positions of governments of not being very critical about what Israel is doing, you know, in Gaza now compared to, say, you know, the degree of criticism, you know, say, leveled at Russia when they were in Grozny in the Caucasus. You know, there's not a lot to say about it other than, you know, the terms like, you know, the right to defend yourself are very flexible terms, you know, depending on your viewpoint and what's acceptable in as a response to an incident and when you're defending yourself.
It's a very challenging situation, and you know, like, my heart goes out to the people of Israel and Palestine, and it's just, and I think it's just best if we stop trying to sort of justify a priori positions and try and just kind of open our hearts to everyone.
All right, thanks for that.
If I can just say one thing.
Yep, go ahead.
I'm a bit interested that the actual information about the United States' involvement with Saudi Arabia in this proxy war seem not to be, it seems to be top secret or something. Because it says here, however, the details of the end of American involvement in the war have yet to be released. So
just as a clarifying question, does that mean we're not sure that, despite you mentioned earlier that there's, you know, a statement about they're going to end support, but we don't actually know whether that support has ended yet? Like, maybe it's going to be ended at some point in the future, but
don't we have a right to know? Don't we have a right? Well, the United States.
Not according to the NSA.
Anyway. Well,
all right. We'll be back in just a couple of moments with our gardening with Embark.
The Cultures Youth Panel are thrilled to announce that this year's Ignite Festival will be taking over the Cultures Historic Theater at 1895 Venables Street from May 15th to May 18th. Ignite is an eclectic festival that celebrates excellence in the emerging arts and is curated entirely by members of the youth panel at the Culch, made up of theater performers, filmmakers, writers, poets, dancers, musicians, visual artists, and more, all between the ages of 13 and 30. Performances this year will include short plays, monologues, poetry, some stand-up comedy, live music, dance, a short film program, and drag performances. Tickets are currently available through the Cultures box office in person, by phone, or online. Tickets are by donation on a sliding scale. Hope to see you there.
Joining me now is Pablo. And here we are with our next segment. Pablo Vimas from Embark will be telling us more about caring for our gardens. Joining me now is Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability Society. We're going to talk about getting the most out of your garden. Welcome to the show, Pablo.
Oh, thank you for having me. Nice to be here.
So we're getting into the good weather now, and I've seen you getting, I don't know if it's your first harvest, but we're already harvesting things.
Correct.
So what do we need to be thinking about?
So we are having our second harvest of all our spring vegetables, mainly leafy greens. So yesterday we have harvests of spinach, arugula, the wild arugula, the regular arugula. Radishes are coming up, so that's quite nice. And so at the moment it's just harvesting everything that's coming that we have planted in the previous months, and as well continue planting more greens until the weather really gets around 18 degrees, and then we just will switch into summer crops.
So, but the existing plants are still on the ground for a while, right?
Yes. We still have some plants in the ground. So we don't remove the plant itself. We just pick the leaves and let the plant continue growing until the flower shows up. I think many gardeners are aware that when the flowers show up, means that the plant will move from making leaves into making seeds.
Right.
And most of the times the leaves turn very bitter. When the plant is on flower and you're still harvesting the leaves, you will have some bitter leaves in there.
Yeah. But so you can top the plant, of course. You can cut the flowers off. Does that make much of a difference, or should you really be thinking of shifting?
It will make a bit of difference because the plant now thinks like, oh, I need to make another flower. So you expand the growing season for a week or two. But yeah, it's better to start moving on, remove the plant and put other crops in there.
Right. Yeah. So would you, once the plant starts flowering, would you put in another plant of the same, or are you starting to look at something different?
What we call in our gardens is crop succession.
Yeah.
So if we are planting leaves, we will move to something different, like a root, mm-hmm. or something like a planting fruits, like a peas.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, or in our case, we've been just moving into planting our tomato plants.
Yeah. Right.
So yes. So we don't plant the same crop because the nutrients that this crop needs will be depleted.
Okay, yeah.
So we don't want to get to that point. So that's why we keep a succession plant, kind of a rotation of crops.
Right. So this might be something we get into more detail in a future chat.
Sure.
But how does that work with the different plants and the nutrients? And what are you thinking about there?
Well, so we have three main nutrients, which are nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium.
Yeah.
Leafy greens, they need lots of nitrogen. And the roots, all the crops that gives our roots, they need potassium.
Yeah.
And then for the fruits, we need phosphorus. So, yeah, so that's each crop, depending where they store the nutrients, we have different needs.
So now that we're getting you're starting to put the summer crops in the ground and bringing new seedlings out too? Is that what?
Oh, yes. So at the moment, the weather is, as we mentioned, is nice and warm. So it's time to start thinking in bringing out all the summer crops that we have been growing indoors, such as eggplants, zucchinis, beans, if we started beans, and tomatoes.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the month, sure, it's going to be warm. We can start our crops from seeds itself, like
by the end of the month.
By the end of the month, end of the May, yes. Yeah. We can start corn. We can start zucchinis, watermelons, cantaloupes straight in the garden. So we don't need to think in advance planting indoors.
So it's a real progression of plants we're working at to keep the garden productive.
Correct. Yeah. So in here in Embark, we have small boxes, 4x4 feet, and we can try to optimize that space, keeping crops moving and keep the harvesting coming. So yeah. Right.
And you've mentioned the week numbers. We've talked about that a few times. I think we're week 18 now.
Correct.
That can be really, really be your guide. So maybe you can talk a little bit more about that before we finish up.
Yeah. So week 18 is. Now we only have 6 more weeks for the equinox. No, sorry, for the summer solstice, June 21st.
Yeah.
And after the summer solstice, summer is here.
Yeah.
So we need to by week 26, we have to have all our crops out for the summer.
Right.
Do not start any seeds by that time. For instance, if you say, oh, I want to grow tomatoes, and you bring your tomatoes, your seed of tomatoes on week 26, you will spend most of the time the plant growing. At the end in September, October, you will have just green tomatoes, not the red juicy tomatoes that you were expecting.
Excellent. So we're getting our summer, we've been growing our summer plants for a little while indoors now.
Correct. Yeah.
And now we're moving into the outdoors. And we're going to start tending them to see them grow. When would we, I guess it depends plant by plant, but when would we start to see fruit and other produce from them?
So the first produce that we'll see will be at the end of June.
Yeah.
Beginning of July,
yeah.
Most of our gardeners here in Vancouver use the long weekend of May in order to go out and plant all the summer crops.
Great.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much for giving us these insights.
Oh, you're welcome.
It's definitely with something you got to be thinking about all the time to really make your garden work.
Correct. Yeah. So our gardening is quite active. We keep moving. It's nothing static. And on top of that, we need to keep maintaining, watering, weeding, keeping the plagues and pests out of the garden. So this is the very busy season in the garden.
Excellent. Yeah. Thanks so much for joining us today, Pablo Vimas of Embark. Tell us how to find out more about Embark.
Embark, you can reach us at embarksustainability.org or our social media at Embark Sustain.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Pablo will be back next week for another session on gardening with Embark. All right. Thanks for the good show today, guys. Great discussion.
Pleasure.
Tell us about when that play is happening. One quickly.
Yeah, the general run is going to start on May 17th at 7 p.m. at the Waterfront Theater on Granville Island. And I think ticket prices are like $29 for students and $35 for adults.
Excellent. And what are you going to be talking about? Do you know what you're talking about next week, Peter?
Well, what I proclaimed last week, I said it was the whole Linen Lurum organization, but I wanted to bring up the thing about Yemen, because I thought it was important, but I'll be talking about that for next week.
All right. Thank you for listening today. Democracy Now! Will be up in about 15 seconds. More great programming here on CGSF, Wandering Rhythms at noon, typically Tuesday up at 3 p.m., and lots more here on CGSF 90.1 FM.